I wonder, have you ever been in a situation where you made a bad choice? Or when things just worked out badly? Or when you felt really stupid or really cross with yourself? You can put your hand up if you ever have been in that situation. Some people have, that's reassuring, because I certainly have. Perhaps you expected other people in that situation to judge you, to say how stupid you were as well. And if that was the case, you really hoped they wouldn't ask you, or hope you would, they wouldn't find out. Or if you know that they're going to know, you kind of steel yourself to suffer at their hands. Well, when Samuel and Emma, our eldest two, are both very young, Tracy and I made a rather silly decision to take them for a February holiday by the seaside in England. We'd read in the paper about a small and reasonably priced hotel, and it sounded wonderful. And we forgot that it would be cold and miserable weather, rather like it was yesterday here in Walton-on-the-Hill. We hardly ever went to anything other than self-catering, so it was supposed to be a treat. But it was awful. It was dirty, it was cold, there were horrible rooms, even more horrible food. And although we'd paid for three nights, we left after one, and we felt miserable. We'd spent our money, but not got what we wanted, and it was mostly our own fault, though I felt like writing a stiff letter to the newspaper. The hotel has been demolished now, and there are some lovely new houses there, which eases the pain I sometimes still feel. Well, why am I telling you this story? I'm telling it because I've been trying to think how that young couple in Cana of Galilee must have been feeling during their wedding celebration when the wine ran out. They must have been feeling sick. It must have been awful. Many of you here have planned weddings. Many of you have been at weddings. Many of you have been the bride and groom at weddings. And I bet that didn't happen to you. Did it happen to you? It may have happened to you. It probably feels awful if it happened to you. Well, our reading started by saying, on the third day. It's not referring to the third day of the wedding. It's referring to the third day of Jesus gathering his disciples together. At this stage, he has five, not 12. And he goes on this day with his mum to a wedding. It's probable that the parents of the bride and groom were family friends or even relatives of Mary. And the disciples are invited along as well, because in Middle Eastern hospitality, to add on five extra guests at the last minute was entirely normal. They wouldn't have batted an eyelid. But maybe rather too many extra guests had been added on because the wine ran out. And this was not a good thing. No couple wanted to be known as the couple whose wedding ran out of wine. And maybe they had planned badly or been over-optimistic about the amount their guests would drink. Maybe the guest list had grown. Maybe they were not very rich, and maybe they'd just spent all their budget. But here is Mary, perhaps feeling a little over-concerned and a little responsible for the five extra guests, but also Mary knowing one or two things about her son, who steps forward and takes the problem to Jesus. It wasn't her responsibility, nor was it Jesus's, and nor was it the timing that Jesus really wanted. But Mary says to the servants, "You go and do whatever he tells you to. Do whatever he tells you to." And now here comes the exciting bit. Here comes the mathematics. Look at verse 6. We're told there were six stone water jars. We reckon that there are about 120 gallons of water here. Water used for ceremonial purposes, for ritual purification. And these 120 gallons, near enough, are turned into enough wine to fill 600 wine bottles or 50 cases. It would take a lot of people a long time to consume that amount of wine. Even some of the best drinkers among us today would take quite a long time to work their way through that. Ruth looks at Dan. Now, a little comment from Pope Benedict I read. He commented about this water, because it was water for ritual purification. He said, its inner expectation is brought to fulfillment. Ritual purification, in the end, is just ritual, a gesture of hope. Everything man does on his own remains water before God, but Jesus transforms water into wine. I love it that Jesus did not judge or condemn the couple. He didn't just add a little plonk onto the wine list or a little van der Tarbe. He provided an amazing abundance of absolutely incredible wine. And how do we know that? Because the steward, the master of the banquet, verse 9, gives him a great telling off. Look at verse 9 and 10. Verse 10, you can hear his indignation. Everyone brings out the choice wine first, and then the cheaper wine after the guests have had too much to drink. But you've saved the best until now. That was not a good thing. That was a terrible thing, a bad thing. The man is really angry that they've all been made to drink the rubbish stuff first and have been holding on to and hoarding the really good stuff. That's the best evidence of the quality of the wine that Jesus produced out of these water for ritual purification. And John, the gospel author, then gives us in verse 11 a succinct summary of what was going on. He says that the miracle was the first of the signs that Jesus did, a sign that revealed his glory as well as rescuing a wedding party. And most importantly, look at that last phrase, his disciples believed in him. Can you say that with me? His disciples believed in him. He's saying a layer of faith was put down in their hearts and in their lives. I think I've told you this before, but it won't hurt to hear it again, that many years ago, in the days when we had radio cassette players in cars, and there's little tiny cassette players that occasionally ate the tape and made a funny noise, I had a little cassette tape of John's Gospel on a long car journey to West Wales. And as I was listening to John's Gospel, I heard something I hadn't spotted when I was reading it, because I knew it quite well, but I hadn't heard this before. And it's the phrase we just all said together, his disciples believed in him. It's a phrase that comes several times in John's Gospel, and it's really, really helpful. It reminds us that their faith was built up in layers. They didn't go from having no faith to having masses of faith in the click of a thumb and a finger or in a moment. It was a process. If you think of plywood, plywood's a very useful material that is lots of sheets of very, very thin bits of wood glued together and put under pressure that makes something very strong and durable and useful. And it's a bit like that. Jesus' disciples developed layers of belief over time as they lived with him, heard what he said, saw how he lived, witnessed what he did, and those layers laid down upon each other, glued together under pressure, became really strong. It helps for us to remember that it took time for them, and it is likely to have taken and still take time for us. So being a disciple of Jesus and believing in him, it does often have a moment or several moments, perhaps, where the penny drops or the light bulb comes on or you have a eureka moment. But it's also a process. It has a moment or several moments, perhaps, of commitment where you say, Jesus, I want to follow you. Dear God, I'm going to turn my life around and try and follow in your direction. But it's also a process. And there's very, very good news for us all from this reading from John chapter 2 this morning, as we're in that business of growing in faith. It's a message about how God responds to us when perhaps we've messed up or life has gone wrong or we've made a bad decision or when we feel vulnerable or feel exposed or feel stupid when we expect others to say we're stupid and we perhaps think we have to hang our heads in shame. Because the way Jesus responds in Cana shows us how God responds to us. And if in a little village at a simple wedding between two peasant people, when the wine ran out, if in that context Jesus provided far more than they could possibly drink, a wasteful abundance of quality they had never tasted before, if he did that to save the embarrassment of a bride and groom, what will his approach to us be? Can we not put our trust in him? He doesn't treat us as we deserve. He doesn't look at us in order to tell us off, but with compassion, looking to help us. In each crisis, when we turn to him, there'll be a difference. On each day of exhaustion, where we seek him, there will be a difference. He invites us to experience his presence and his power, his faithfulness and his friendship. And even when life is hard, in fact, especially when life is hard, we'll find those layers of faith are being built up. So today, however you're feeling, let me encourage you to carry on holding on to him. And the story I began with, our holiday story, turned out rather well. A very kind person who could have said to us how stupid you were, instead paid for us to go on a better holiday after Easter, and it was very nice, though Emma's probably too small to remember.